Welcome back to Midori House. Now, global human population has experienced steady growth since the end of the 14th century. There are currently over 7 billion of us, and according to the UN's top demographics experts, we will be as many as 10.1 billion by 2100.
Well, this is something we have to get prepared for so that we know how to deal with the scarcity of resources. And in his book, Population 10 Billion, The Coming Demographics Crisis and How We Survive It, geographer Danny Dorling has mapped out a guide to the decades to follow. Danny Dorling joins us now in studio to discuss his book. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
How fundamentally will an almost 50% rise in the world's population change our lives in the future?
We're going to get more crowded. It's not just that population's going up, it's that it's actually going down in rural parts of the world. So it's going up even more in cities. So we're going to become an urban creature. Already half of us live in cities. That's going to become the large majority of us, and these cities are going to be different kinds of cities to the ones we've been used to.
And Danny, I mean, we speak about this a lot on Monocle 24, the urbanisation in general, but also sort of the ageing populations.
Yes.
And it seems that, obviously, population growth is happening more in developing countries rather than first world countries, which are facing something at the other end of the scale of people just living longer.
Yes.
But what is the cause for such a gigantic expansion?
Well, people are also beginning to live longer in countries in the middle-ranking countries. In a way, we always talk about ageing. We never talk about how we're just getting less young people, you know, which is what we need to get if we're going to stop at around about 10 billion, 11 billion. The cause of the expansion, it all began, as you say, it began in the 14th century. It was quite slow. It took off around about 1851. And from 1851 to 1971, we had a population explosion, like an algae bloom of human beings. Since 1971, it's slowed down. I think what made it all start in 1851 was trade and capitalism distorting traditional systems whereby people controlled their fertility. And capitalism and population growth went hand in hand. They've got the same geography and the same history. And when you have more and more young people, you can always make money as a capitalist. You can sell more because your market's always getting bigger. That then disrupts traditional societies and you get more population growth. The really interesting thing is to ask, why did the rate of growth slow down after 1971? And it's good, we're going to be approaching a plateau, but the traditional way of making money out of more and more people isn't going to work in future because there aren't going to be more and more young people. So that market in particular is shrinking.
Danny, you just said that in the future, ever more people are going to be living in the cities, and as a result, the cities are going to be different from what we know. What are they going to be like?
Well, we have to look to Asian cities, I think, to see the best guides. You have to look at Shanghai and Hong Kong and so on to see cities which are quite crowded but quite organised. Tokyo, of course, is a brilliant example of one of the most livable, very large cities in the world. One thing about these cities is that they have an average approaching one child per couple. So, which, you know, it's halving. So these are going to be cities where people come into all the time, which of course is traditionally what a city is, but at a kind of higher rate. We're probably going to see greater rates of immigration and moving around than we've been used to worldwide, because those parts of the world which are ageing the most are going to need more young people. Other parts of the world have more young people. They don't want to lose all their young people, but they can afford to lose some. But getting our mindset in places like Tokyo or London or Paris or Berlin to the idea that actually we shouldn't be putting these walls up quite so tightly as we age, that's going to be tricky to do.
People generally talk about, so rather than the 10 billion sort of phenomenon as something to be scared of, but actually your book offers quite an optimistic approach. Maybe tell us how you've arrived at that and explain why actually it's not something to be so scared of. Maybe.
The optimism is because of this slowdown, because as I said, in 1971 we put on the brakes. We're still going forward, but we put on the brakes. We hit peak baby in 1990, the highest number of babies ever born in a year worldwide. We're probably never going to have as many babies again. I think we've hit about peak 18-year-old now. So my reason for not being scared of population growth is that population growth is ending, and it's ending largely voluntarily. Most of the reason is people making their own decisions to have fewer children. There are a huge number of global problems left. In the book, I list 42 things to worry about that are more important than population growth. I do think it's possible that our grandchildren could have a better life than we have, but a better life might not be a more greedy life.
But anyhow, it seems that we are going to be about 3 billion more after the following 90 years or so. What is the most essential thing or two most essential things that we should concentrate on in order to survive this population explosion?
For the population to be stable, the population of the world needs to be happier. When people are happier, they had fewer babies. To be happier, you need to look at global inequalities in income and wealth. If we carry on with the levels of inequalities in income and wealth we have globally now, we can't hope to stop at 10 billion and things look much worse. That's the first one. The second one is our carbon emissions. We are going to have to bring them down, and the people who have to bring them down most are the people who are emitting most. Otherwise, other people will try to copy them because it becomes a lifestyle to emulate. And if the lifestyle of those who are polluting the most is emulated, again, we have a massive problem. But these are not insurmountable problems. If you look 100 years ago in where we are now in London, London, you might have said, was surrounded with horses. It was absolutely full of horses. And you might have said, oh, people in the rest of the world, they're all going to want to have hansom cabs. They're all going to want to be taken around by horses, and the world will fill up with what horses produce. Now, that didn't happen. Similarly, the way that our big cities at the moment, some of them are dominated by cars. I can't see them being dominated by cars in 100 years' time. Cars are a very inefficient, old, dirty, dangerous technology. But as long as we get ourselves out of cars and, say, back onto bikes. So it's not about new technologies, it's just about doing things in a clever way.
I love your optimism.
You also, in this book, you're also emphasising, besides concentrating on the population explosion, you're also looking what happens after that. We should also start thinking about what happens when the population has reached its top and when the population will go into decline.
Yes, and starts to shrink. I mean, we don't have many models of this. After the Black Death, this is one of these examples, you certainly no longer have a housing problem. But also the value of young people rises dramatically, that the value of labourers after the Black Death rose. And we should be thinking about this period, because this is the period we're actually heading to. This is a UN medium variant projection. And it alters all kinds of things you plan. For instance, I work in a university. Universities have for decades been operating under the idea that we're going to get more people next year than the year before. So we've got to chuck these 18, 19 and 21-year-olds out quickly to make space for the next ones. We don't have to do that in future because there'll be fewer younger children coming in. We don't need to crowd so much education into those early years of life, which, to be honest, I think is a bit too concentrated. So learning could be spread much more over our longer lives in future. Whereas I can see why we do it the way we do it now, but we do it the way we do it now because we've been going through this population explosion and that's coming to an end.
That sounds like a fundamental way we need to change our ways of thinking. And that what you said, it almost makes me think that this is a positive problem. But yeah. What is the worst thing about that when population starts going into decline?
There can be bad things. I mean, another example of a place which, in fact, the only island on the planet which went into decline is Ireland. Ireland has never got back to its population it had in 1840. There's almost nowhere else you can find like this. And losing a sense of things are going downwards is difficult to cope with. Parts of Eastern Europe more recently have had decline. If it's not dealt with well, you can get a sense of depression. You can get a sense of underused utilities. The sewer systems, the roads and so on aren't used. And this is partly why I say we need to open up to the idea of spreading people around a bit better so that we don't suddenly see our great big cities in the first world becoming less and less used and a bit soulless as places. If you want to go really far forward, what happens if it becomes normal, as it is now in Barcelona and Shanghai, to have one child per couple worldwide? How would we cope in 150 years, 200 years with population halving every generation? But that's a long way away.
Luckily, we still have a few years to figure out the answers to those questions. Yeah. That was Danny Darling, author of Population 10 Billion. You're listening